When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Dream Job Ready. My name is Dane Sharp, I'm your host, and my guest for this episode is Denny Keynes, who boasts a 20-year media career packed full of dream jobs, including roles with Twitter, ESPN, and most recently, NextVR.
Please note that the opinions of guests are their own and not those of the companies they have worked for.
G'day Denny, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Mate, where are you and how are you going right now?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Los Angeles, California, just sort of getting ready for hopefully what will be another cracking couple of months of good weather. But and just finished 4 years at NextVR, which is an incredible journey and a ton of fun.
Mate, when I look at your job and the work you've done over the last 4 years, that is my definition of a dream job, personally, and I think just professionally for billions of other people around the world. For the listener that doesn't know too much about NextVR and doesn't yet know what you have done there for the last 4 years, can you give us a quick cut on the company, what it's been doing, and then more importantly, what your work there has allowed you to do over the last 4 years?
Yeah, of course. So NextVR, the leader in live event broadcasting and virtual reality. So we would do basically anything that you would, any live event that you would traditionally travel to, live sports, live music, for example, we would replicate that virtually, and we would put you courtside at a live NBA game, or behind the glass at a hockey game, or front row at a Live Nation concert. Basically, sort of live ticketed events, but we did it virtually, and we would teleport you courtside, and it was a ton of fun, and it was four really incredible years. I mean, the learning curve was like that. I mean, you know, VR is a entirely new medium. And coming into it, obviously I had a background in content and broadcast, but coming into it, I thought, you know, I could wrap my head around this. But it was the most challenging period of my career to date, because everything was new. I mean, so the content deals, the content pipeline, the content production, the content distribution, the way the content was monetized, the way that people consumed the content. I mean, everything about virtual reality was new and emerging. And that four-year journey was constantly, everything was evolving. I mean, our business model was evolving, the partnerships were evolving, the way we produced the content was evolving, the way we were monetizing it was evolving. So incredibly sort of fluid couple of years, very agile, and of course it was a startup, right? So that in itself inherently is laced with complexity and challenges and a lot of reward as well.
Now, the journey to this job obviously is, varied and plentiful, and we'll get into some of that in this episode. Very quickly, you were at Twitter, so, you know, big company, big brand, and you had an amazing dream job there before you left. A couple of different roles, but head of sports partnerships for North America for Twitter before you moved to NextVR. How did you get the job at NextVR? How did a startup pull you away from Twitter?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I reflect on it all the time. And really, circumstance and opportunity just collided at this moment in time. And I was sitting at the US Open Tennis in my role as head of North American Sports Partnerships. And there was a guy two rows in front of me that had a VR headset. And I looked down a couple of seats and I was like, hey, mate, like, what's all that about? And he said, oh, it's a live broadcast of the US Open Tennis. And I said, oh, can I have a look? And I put it on. And I mean, that was the game changer for me. I just sort of, couldn't believe the quality and the clarity back then. of the product they were delivering, and that was a guy called Dave Kramer, who was ultimately, he was the COO at NextVR at the time. And over the course of about a year, we just continued to speak and would run into each other at conferences, or we would occasionally chat on email for different bits and pieces. And then I was sort of been at Twitter at that point about 4 years, and I just sort of felt like the learning curve had tapered off a little bit. And they asked me if I wanted to come and join them, and I thought, why not? So at that point in time, the crew was about a pretty small number of people at NextVR, probably maybe a dozen, definitely no more than two dozen anyway. And then when we finished, you know, we were about 150 people, but really early days and a great experience and an awesome company to be part of from the very, very beginning.
Yeah, mate, circumstance and opportunity collide. It's always a big decision what to do next, whether that's within a company you're working for or to make a jump to a different company. Yeah, was there any fear factor in this at all for you, or was it just a layup because you know where the world's going from a VR and AR and content consumption point of view?
If I reflect back, I have more fear about doing it what I did now than I did at the time. And what I mean by that is I kind of shocked myself that I did it, actually, because in reflection, I'm like, I had a great career path at Twitter. I'd been in Australia. We helped open the operation there. They'd moved me to New York. I was running North American sports partnerships out of New York. I was running the global TV team. The company was still growing incredibly fast. During that period, we'd gone from before the IPO, we took it to the public markets, and now we're post-IPO. There was a lot of buzz around the company. We were doing incredible things. We just brought streaming to the platform. I did the original deal with the NFL to bring those streaming rights for Thursday Night Football to Twitter. That was the first time that Thursday Night Football had been streamed on a social platform. And then I just threw it all in and went to NextVR. And at the time, no, I didn't think twice about it. I went, this felt right. It felt like the right move at the right time, the right group of people, the right industry to be in, and the right challenge. But in reflection, I don't know where I found the courage to do it, because if now, as we talk about it, I look back at it and go, you know, most people would say you're crazy. But I'm so thankful that I did it, because it's been a really great journey.
Yeah, mate, that's, you know, it's humbling, but that's awesome to look back on it like that. You know, it's certainly if it just felt right, you know, you say trust your gut. You know, sometimes you get to do that. Sometimes you don't. You have to make a brain decision, yeah. But that's amazing. You know, you mentioned Australia there. We can obviously hear your Australian accent. Let's go back. You were born and raised in Australia, Charles Sturt University, Bachelor of Arts degree. You know, take us back to life in Australia before going and getting dream jobs over in the States.
Yeah, it's weird, because if you reflect, I remember so many times early on, especially when I was at uni, I looked at people working in media or in the sports business or network television, and it was so unfathomable for me to understand how those people got into those positions. Right, I was like, it just felt like too out of my reach, too far to sort of, you know, to travel in your career. I didn't know anybody in those industries. I came from Bungendore, which was like a small country town just outside of Canberra. I'd been at, you know, uni in Wagga, but was not from choice. It was because I couldn't get into the Fine Arts College in Sydney. So I was sort of going to this like second or third choice. It could have even been my third choice uni. And it was in, you know, the middle of nowhere. And if I think back, I can't imagine that if I was talking to that kid today saying it's going to be okay, this is where you're going to end up, I wouldn't believe it for a second. But I went to Wagga and I did a TV production course there for a couple of years. And then I moved to Sydney and I got the opportunity to make coffee and tea for the hosts on the Today Show, which was Tracy Grimshaw and Steve Liebman at the time, through a connection that was through the uni, because the uni was sort of placing people in these sorts of different internship roles. Yeah, like a work experience role. And so I did that unpaid for a couple of weeks. And then the EP at the time, Steve Wood, said to me at the end of the couple of weeks of the work experience, he said, are you coming in on Monday? And I said, it's finished. I've got to go back to uni. And he said to me, well, when uni's finished at the end of the year, give me a call. And so I actually did give him a call when I got to Sydney when uni had finally wrapped for the year. And he said, come in on Monday and come and meet me in the office. So I went to the office and he forgot he'd set up to meet me. So he wasn't there. He was out at lunch. And I just felt so crushed. I was like, I had put so much promise into this idea that I was meeting with the executive producer of the Today Show, and I was coming out of uni, and you know, maybe I was going to get like a job because of that work experience. And he didn't turn up to the meeting, and so I just sort of, you know, went home with my tail between my legs. And then he called me a couple of days later and said, "Can you come in and start on Monday?" He didn't even choose to meet, and I was like, "Yes," and I was like, "Whoa, that's incredible!" And then my journey at the Nine Network was a really good couple of years, just working with great people and just climbing my way up from coffee boy to eventually finished as a producer on 60 Minutes, and that in itself was a really great period of my career.
That's great, mate, and you know, that's such an interesting story of the transition from uni to the work, because it's not easy. I've talked about it in previous episodes around, you know, the stats are alarmingly growing of, the more difficult and the longer wait it takes a lot of people to get jobs out of uni, let alone everything that's been going on in 2020. Look, if I can ask you this week's listener question of the week right now, because I think it's quite fitting and I've got it penned here, and I think it's a good jump off from what you were just talking to there, and I think you'll have some great advice. This week's question is from Shannon. And the question is getting a marketing or media degree from university an outdated practice from long ago, or is it still an important prerequisite and opportunity to get employed in the marketing and media industry today?
Yeah, it's really important, but only if you look at it through very specific lenses. I didn't learn anything outrageously interesting at university, right? It's nothing that I wouldn't have learned in that period that I probably wouldn't have learned in the job, certainly in television. But what I did learn was a lot about how to study, how to really put an essay together, or how to put my words together, how to communicate better, learn a lot about deadlines. I learned about sort of the work-life balance in a sense because of you're going into a period of your life where you actually get to make choices on your own, and you have to make decisions, and there are consequences to those decisions. And so there's a lot of stuff that university taught me that I wasn't expecting to get taught. And there's a lot of people that, unfortunately, this is the way it is that they do carry, it does carry a lot of weight. So a lot of like decent jobs, entry-level jobs these days require a BA or some sort of degree or some sort of study. And that really, a lot of the time, even at entry level, is to prove that you've got commitment and to prove that you're willing to put your head down and work hard and you know, that you're sort of willing to put the hard yards in when it comes to the career. So unfortunately, I say unfortunately because for a lot of people, there isn't that opportunity, right? They either can't afford it or they just can't get in. And certainly there are, you know, thousands of stories out there of people who've had really incredibly successful careers who didn't get a full education. But the only piece of advice I'd say is it gets harder for you, that's all. So you have to work harder and you have to be a little luckier and you have to get a little bit more opportunity come your way without having that degree behind you. And so it just sort of, getting the degree ultimately shortens the odds to you getting a better job in the long run.
Yeah, I like that, mate. And if I could echo a couple of things that I really liked what you said there. One is around that decision-making. It is elevated decision-making from leaving high school, for sure. Whether that is because it's a more vigorous deadline or timeline to do it, or even just the breadth of decisions you have to make. As you said, you're out on your own almost for the first time for a lot of people. So that is super critical, and just learning that is so beneficial because it's, you know, it doubles down again when you actually go and get a job. And the second one I really think is important is around the commitment. It's another elevated level of commitment that you have to deliver. And I think that's what kind of people look for. And if you've got a uni degree, it's as much going, okay, that person's committed themselves and gone out and actively learned for 2, 3, 4, whatever it is, years, and they can, they're going to bring that into the job ready to go, as opposed to I'm going to have to coach them through that.
And you do learn foundational. When I said I didn't learn a lot, you do learn the foundations of the industry that you're walking into, just the bare bones basics, which is critical too for an employer.
Let's jump from that to the fact that now, over the last 4 years, or a good breadth of that, you've been leading and managing a huge team. You know, you're talking 50, 60 plus level of staff, creatives, producers, etc. Can you talk about that team? And I guess more importantly, what advice can you share from having to deal with all those people on a daily basis for the listener out there that's trying to break into media production, etc.?
Yeah, you know, the best employees are the ones that can't have a can-do attitude, that just can get the job done. You know, I like to surround myself with people who don't just tell you about the problem, but they'll tell you about how they're going to solve the problem. So I've got no problem with anybody, you know, coming to me on any given day and saying, you know, Danny, you know, this has gone wrong, or this is the problem today, or this is what we need, you know, to solve. I mean, that's my job, right? In a sense, is to help them and make sure I can remove the roadblocks and ensure that I can give them a clear path to getting something done. But I always get a little frustrated with people who come in and just tell me the problem and just leave it there, and without a solution or without sort of, you know, active steps for how we can solve the problem. And it seems obvious when we talk about it now, but for a lot of people that are in the job, certainly in the early days, it's not clear to them. They think that they go to their boss with a problem and their boss will solve it. Yes, they will, but ultimately, like, come with the solution and then your boss will help you, you know, clear the path for you to get it solved with your solution. So that stuff is kind of been critical for me, is surrounding myself with the sort of can-do people. And then the rest is pretty easy. I mean, there's plenty of people that I've hired who are actually much better at the job than me. The thing which has been key in my career is, certainly as you grow a team, when I started at NextVR, I was just the only person on the content team doing the entire flow of production. So it was the deal acquisitions or content deals. What sort of content do we think makes sense for the NextVR fan? Going and securing those deals, or negotiating them, bringing those deals in, and then overseeing the production of those deals, thinking about the content strategy for not just production, but the distribution and the programming of it. And ultimately, syndication and monetization of it. Monetization, I'd hand off to the sales team, but still part of that process. And over time, as the team grew, I could break all those individual things I was doing. I could break them down, and I could bring people into the business that were actually experts at each of those individual roles. So you end up in a position where you're actually surrounded by a bunch of experts who are much better at doing all of these individual things than you ever were. And they all just make you look really good. So, but I mean, that's the key, is like, I could just ultimately then try and, from a leadership position and from a, you know, 36,000 foot view, in a sense, be able to look at the business and decide where we needed to make changes or where we needed to evolve the strategy, and just, and then talk to the people I brought in to run those departments in order to get that stuff going. And it's a pretty efficient way to do it. And you end up with a team of people who not only can do the job better than you, but you have incredible trust and respect for as well, which is super important. Because if you don't have the trust and respect, I mean, there's not a day that I was sending some farewell notes to some of the folks that I've worked with at NextVR over the last couple of weeks. And you know, one of the themes in the notes I was sending to them was that the reality was, is that, like, on any given day, if something went wrong at the business, or if it was ever under sort of some sort of pressure to get something done, they alleviated a lot of that, because I knew that they could deliver. I knew that if I went to, I had Josh, who was my head of production, I knew when there was a problem with, like, an NFL camera position or an NBA camera position, or somebody was screaming blue murder for something that was shot that got broadcast that shouldn't have, I knew that those things would get solved, because these people that I put around me were absolute experts in their field.
And yeah, can you shed some light on, you know, I imagine there's a plethora of different personality types within that. Can everyone be a problem solver? Can everyone, you know, gain that trust of a manager to be a problem fixer?
They won't always come in as that, but you have to show them the path to what you need. And also you have to be willing to make the hard decisions. I mean, I've fired plenty of people, and not because they were terrible at the job, but just because they weren't necessarily the right cultural fit for my team. And you know, that's the tough thing about tough choices, is that they're tough, right? You have to make them. And sometimes it's not fun, but ultimately, you know, I sort of have this philosophy when it comes to hiring people. Hiring is hard. Like, finding a good person for a job is tough. Finding a great person is almost impossible. And so it's really difficult. You have to do your diligence, and you have to interview them enough, and you have to get enough input as to whether you think they're the right fit. And even then, you could make the wrong decision. But if you hire somebody who's okay or good or even great at the job, you have to look at your best performer on the team, the person who you love and trust and who delivers time and time again. And you have to say to yourself, if I don't hire another one of those people, like, that's all the stuff I'm gonna lose. I'm gonna lose all the great things that amazing employee is. And that's a great lens to look through, because then you look at these people who are, oh, he could be pretty good for the job, and realize pretty good doesn't cut it. Like, they have to be a superstar. And you can't compromise on that stuff, because ultimately it'll impact the business all the way down the chain, unless you get the right fit in the role from the very beginning. Because nobody likes sitting in a room and having to fire someone. Like, that's just the worst part of any job. But ultimately, that's what happens if you don't do the diligence in the hiring process in the first place.
Yeah, that's golden. You know, when you get that right person, it's immediate almost how much of a difference that makes. Let's roll reverse it for a second, because obviously you would have hired a lot of people and gone through that whole process with a lot of people throughout your career, but specifically in the last 4 years with that big team. If you had to give yourself advice to kind of go into that kind of job application, step me through it. Like, how do I divulge that type of personality traits and enthusiasm and you know, ask for that trust, starting with, I guess, the resume upwards, if you can help me break that down.
You'll look at, I mean, the one piece of advice that I would give myself, you know, in any situation where it's sort of reporting up in structure, is that you, as a direct report, think about your manager a lot more than your manager thinks about you, right? Because the nature is like, that manager has 5, maybe 10, maybe even more people like reporting up to them. But they're the only person that you are thinking about all the time. So you've got to give them, you have to build enough trust for them to know that you're just getting the job done and you're low maintenance and you're delivering. If you're the sort of direct report who constantly is asking for advice, constantly going in and checking in, constantly trying to show your worth, constantly asking for validation on something you've done, ultimately you actually become a thorn in their side, because they want you to, most managers want you to have enough confidence in yourself to make the decisions, to believe in that you can get the job done without needing constant validation that you're doing a great job. And the very nature of giving yourself a little bit of distance from your direct manager also means that when you do go to them with a problem, when you do go to them with an issue, they'll listen 10 times more intently at what you're saying, because you're not in there all the time talking about stuff. And that's how you build trust, I think, and that's how you build the great dynamic between in that reporting structure, is just not wasting their time. Like, going to them only the important stuff, and just the rest of the time, head down, get the job done, deliver results, and have confidence that if they're not constantly in your inbox or constantly calling you or constantly texting you, that's a good thing, because they trust that you're getting the job done.
Yeah, and as you said before, you know, if it is a problem, have a opinion on a solution. The other key part that I've sort of witnessed is make it as relevant as you can to that manager, because if they do have that minute at the time, and it's not easy being a manager, if it's relevant to them, they're going to care a little bit more than if it sort of just seems like a left of field thing. That's great, yeah. Mate. Another question for you as well, just out of the people you've been working with, are you one that looks at it and when you're hiring someone, you kind of expect that they've experienced or used, you know, your product or your platform, or is there people that you work with that, I guess, aren't necessarily in NextVR's point of view, virtual reality enthusiasts, and they're more just experts in their trade at what they're working on?
It depends on the role. Diversity of opinion is super important, and bringing somebody into the business that had applied for a job but wasn't necessarily a VR enthusiast or hadn't necessarily looked at VR content, for most people would be a problem. I don't necessarily think it is. I would look at those people and be curious as to like why they hadn't, and try and use those reasons as to a way to get new users onto the platform. You know, okay, so what was it about VR that stopped you from wanting to try it? What was it about you that never got put the headset on? Now, if it was directly content related, maybe that's a bit of an issue. But if it was like a data analysis, or if it was somebody who was coming in a different function that wasn't really specific to the content but was important to build the company, I'd be a little bit more lenient. But I think generally, once again, when we talk about reducing the odds to getting the job, the people that would always impress me were the people who come in and had tried the content, tried the app, could talk about their experiences. I mean, that stuff is makes it easier for me to hire them than somebody who's really great at the job but had never actually even opened the app in the first place.
Great to know. I think that's great advice. Mate, NextVR, it's a company, as I mentioned, I discovered it through the MBA. I have had a chance to do a lot of webcasting and broadcasting with Rip Curl back in the day, so I'm also interested in, you know, broadcasting and streaming. So that's a company I look at and I was like, you know, wow, and your job title is dream job material. But, you know, when I look through your career, mate, you've had some amazing jobs for some amazing brands, and I'll get to a question in a second, but, you know, we're talking Twitter, we're talking 60 Minutes, ESPN, you know, Channel 9, as it says. When you look at your career, because even though we're both young at heart, companies like Twitter and NextVR, or for me, you know, eBay and Groupon, they weren't around back when we were at school and going to uni. So they're new companies, but massive. What's made you successful throughout this journey that you've had through in your career, from those humble days at that third choice university onwards to where you are now?
I think it's hard to put it down to just one or two things. I think there's characteristics. There's some people who go to one company and they'll spend 30 years of their life there, right? And that's sort of very much the American culture way here, is people who go to ESPN from the beginning of time and they wake up 30 years later and they're an SVP of whatever. And there's nothing wrong with that. I just have been much more of a sort of transient sort of, you know, feel about my career, where I've sort of continually moved around, continually tried new things. Darren Wick, who's the head of news and current affairs for the Nine Network, calls me a gypsy, because certainly in the early days, because I would bounce around a little bit, right? And now I bounced around only for a few reasons, but the main reason was because I came in as the coffee boy and I was always going to be the coffee boy. I had to leave and come back to be seen as someone a little bit different, and I had to leave and come back. And so I came and went from Nine three times, as I was a coffee boy, and then I went up and was a researcher, and then I left and I traveled, went overseas for a couple of years. I came back, and then when I came back, I was no longer the coffee boy. I was the guy who was the researcher. Then I left and went upstairs to be a producer at A Current Affair. And then I left, and when I came back, I was, oh, that's Danny, who was the producer at A Current Affair. Then I went to the footy show as a supervising producer. But it kind of helped break my career up a little bit to be seen through a different lens and not just be seen as always, oh, that's the coffee boy who's now doing this. But that doesn't mean that's the right path, because at the end of the day, you probably still both, whichever path you choose, you probably still both end up as the SVP of whatever you know, wherever you are, be it 30 years or be it on and off coming in and out of a career. But the reason I did it, and this is going to sound, I mean, it should resonate with people, but it was just the nature of where I was at in my life, is I went to different jobs because I was going to get paid more a lot of the time. Right? I mean, it was still within TV. It was still interesting. But ultimately, I saw opportunities to get a 10 grand pay rise. And I was like, I'm going to go and work here because I can get a little bit more money. And it mattered to me back then. I mean, I started my career in television and my salary was $32,000 a year. And it wasn't a lot to live on back then, and obviously a lot less now. And so an extra 5 or 10 grand made a huge difference to my lifestyle. So I did a bit of that, and then ultimately what I did discover was that I was very drawn to storytelling. I've always been a storyteller. And what I mean by always being a storyteller, I'm the guy who will, you know, goes to a party and I just talk about things. I'll talk about like stuff. I'm always just retelling stories like that. And of course I applied that to television. And the interesting stuff for me was when the big sort of where I deviated from TV and went into tech was because Twitter was looking to open the Australian operation. And at that point in time, they discovered that a lot of the conversation that was taking place on the platform was around television programming. It was a sort of social TV phenomenon that we all came to know. And as a tech company, they really didn't have a lot of understanding of the TV business or how to harness the power of their platform when it came to TV programming. Certainly didn't really know how to speak TV or get into the TV businesses. And so they went and hired a bunch of people that worked in TV. And I was just fortunate enough to get a call one day when I was at 60 Minutes, and they asked me to go to dinner one night and meet with them. And that for me was the turning point, because I saw the opportunity to take everything I'd learned for the last decade and apply it to an entirely different industry, in a sense, that still had very strong, at its core, still had a lot of things I could relate to as it pertained to TV, right? So that was probably the big turning point, was sort of getting into Silicon Valley tech, in a sense, and having the opportunity to do all the crazy stuff I did at Twitter at the time.
Mate, thank you for being so honest about that. I love the truth around you know, those moves for pay. We typically kind of hide and, you know, keep that kind of stuff secret. But you know, certainly in the younger parts of career, and it lasts forever. It may waver a little bit on a motivational level, but you know, you're 100% right. If you want a pay rise, sometimes, more often than not, the easiest way is you got to jump.
And because sometimes, like, you'll get very easily taken for granted as well, like by a boss who, I mean, I've taken my moves with me my entire career, in the sense that I always make sure that people are getting their reviews. I always make sure people are getting a pay increase. I'm always going into fight for budgets for my staff, because I know what I was like, especially with the younger kids. I'm like, I know exactly, like, that if I'm not careful, and because sometimes I've got kids working for me who are absolute superstars, who will go on and do incredible things with their career. They're like 21, 22. I'm like, you have no idea. Like, if you keep that attitude up, like, you're going to absolutely crush it. And they're 10 times smarter and enthusiastic and energetic than I ever was. But I know I'll lose them, because someone else will nab them, like, very quickly. Or if they start to feel underappreciated, now there's kids who feel like they're sort of their due a job, or they should have, you know, it's their right to be paid, right? And that in itself is problem-ish at times. But the impact now, though, has been that, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this over the last couple of weeks since the Next VR acquisition, is I'm a lot more focused now on doing something with meaning and purpose than I ever have been. And I think it's because the first 10 years of my career were a little bit less about that. And so now, as I'm getting to this stage, it is very much about, like, you know, like what are you doing and why are you doing it? Are really, really important questions. They were less important to me in my 20s.
That's a good segue, Matt. I was going to ask you, you know, what's the motivating factor in a dream job for you now? Like, what gets you up and gets you excited?
Yeah, it has to be having impact in people's lives in a meaningful way. I mean, positive impact, of course. Like, I just am very motivated now about ensuring that whatever it is that I do next, I have the ability to sort of have a positive impact, and I can change, you know, people's lives for the better, in a meaningful way. And that for me, we did a lot of that stuff at Next VR, because I suppose the obvious question is like how did the VR, you know, how did you do that in VR? But when we did a lot of really interesting work, so we did a documentary series, their original programming, and one of the last pieces we did was a story, a mini documentary called Homeless, a Los Angeles story, and we basically followed three people's lives in the streets of LA. They were homeless over a couple of nights in Koreatown, just trying to, like, give some sort of empathy to the homeless problem here, because there's 65,000 people living on the streets of LA on any given night. That's the number they can count. That's not people that are living crap, you know, that are out of job and out of a job and, you know, couch surfing, or that are living in their cars, or, you know, all the crazy stuff that people go through when they're sort of experiencing homelessness. And you can drive down an LA freeway and they just become like noise, right? They just become like, there's just more homeless people. And these are real human beings, right? That had lives, that just fell into a little bit of bad luck, that, you know, there, but for the grace of, you know, for anyone, it could be either you or I mean, a mortgage payment or too late, you lose your job, big medical bill comes in, anything can go wrong. And so trying to give some sort of empathy and let people understand their story and understand that, like, this is how these people live in virtual reality is hugely, like, hugely impactful, because you ultimately get a sense of presence and immersion when you're in the experience. So you, like, now it's not just a homeless person on the side of the street, you're in a tent with them at night in the streets of LA and seeing how they live. And so that's the kind of stuff which I think, when I talk about meaning and purpose, that's the kind of stuff that really motivates me.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that's going to make a difference as well. How does a listener find that?
It was launched at the New York Film Festival 2019 as official selection. It was in the NextVR app until recently, but after the acquisition, we've had to sunset that app for the time being. So it can be found in a couple of places. If you've got an Oculus device, it's in the Oculus TV section of the Oculus store. It's free to watch, and you could watch that on, if you had a Gear VR, Oculus Go, an Oculus Quest, or an Oculus Rift, you'd be able to watch it.
Awesome stuff, mate. Yeah, the opportunity to find that purpose and make an impact. Kudos to you for that, for being a driving factor, because there's a lot going on right now, and I think that that kind of impact is what everyone's looking for. So, look, I'm going to ask for a parting word before we wrap this episode up. I'm going to put you on the spot again in a second. Bit of advice for a job seeker out there. First of all, you know, such a super interesting career journey you've had so far. I can't wait to see what's next. Obviously, NextVR, the business, being acquired by the giant that is Apple. So it's going to be very interesting to kind of see how that all unfolds for that side of the business. Obviously, your career is going to be amazing to watch what's next. And if I could have one parting word for a job seeker that's listening right now, what's the one thing they should do this afternoon, tonight, this morning, whatever time it is that they're listening to, that's going to get them ready for that dream job opportunity that might knock on their door?
Yeah. There's a few people in my career that I've hired who were incredible hires that originally I'd actually said no to. And that's, it's amazing. I still joke about with a couple of these folks all the time. I'm either a terrible hiring manager, or they just saw a weakness in my, like, ability to sort of give them a second chance, but or maybe a strength or something, whatever, however you would define that. One guy, I won't name them just for in case I embarrass them, but one guy I'd said no to, sent me an email and said that I actually think I am the right fit, and I think you're wrong, and I think that you should meet me in person. We'd only done a phone interview, and I'm going to fly myself to your office. I'm going to sit in the foyer. I'm going to be there all day, and if you could find 5 minutes to meet me, I'd appreciate it. And if you can't, I understand, but I'm going to be there. Now, most people would think that person's a crazy, but my recruiter sent me the email and said, like, I don't know, what do you think? And I'm like, get him in here. Get him in here. If he sent that email, or the very least I can do is find some time to meet him in person, because I know how tough that email would have been to send, because I know, like, it's a really tough thing to, like, pick up the courage after you've sort of been beaten down and haven't got a position in a job and been told it's not for you. Like, that's an ego blow, right? It can be crushing. We've all had that. And why not me? Like, what's wrong with me? How come I'm not the right fit for the role? And so I ended up hiring him as one of the best hires I'd ever made. Another hire was a woman who walked in, put her resume on the receptionist desk and said, I really want a job here. I've walked past here, you know, for the last year, every day. I thought it would be a wonderful place to work. This is at NextVR. The resume came to my desk, and the receptionist told me what she said. And I said, well, I don't know, it just doesn't look like the right fit. But I gave it to one of my direct reports and said, look, give her a call and have a chat to her. Tell me what you think. I don't think she's the right fit and I don't really have time to be talking to her. But we should do the right thing. We should at least have a conversation with her. And then he came back to me the next day and said, I think you should talk to her. She's unbelievable. And I said, really? He said, yep. So I spoke to her and I was like, wow, she crushed it. I was like, I want to hire you right now. I was really impressed. And I said, I have to go to my COO to get approval for it. So I went to my CEO and said, look, I'm going to hire this woman. And he said, no, she's not the right fit. I looked at the resume. I said, well, that's what I thought. And I told Josh that. And Josh said she's good. And Josh told me it's when I think she's good. So he said, well, I want to interview her. I said, you can interview her. He hired her in the interview. He said, that's it. Yeah. And I was like, and so many times I've laughed about that because I'm like, there were so many things up against her to get that job. There were all these people that was like, you're not the right fit. And she crushed that interview. And she isn't just a great employee. She's a star employee. And so two stories there about people who were persistent and didn't take no for an answer. Now, some people won't react the way that I reacted. Some people are less willing to have a second conversation or think that's a good character trait. I do. And because I've been proven right twice.
Oh, mate, and I think to break the fear that someone would have to send that second email is worst case scenario, you know, you write back going, you know, thanks, but no thanks, on to the next one. Like it's the life's not over. So, you know, great stories, like great successful stories, those two showed that, you know, persistence and enthusiasm and the willingness to ask or, you know, you don't get what you don't ask for, right? But again, I'll echo, you know, you shouldn't be knocked back if you get a no because it's, you know, it's closer to the yes the next time. So, hey, Denny, really appreciate your time, mate. This has been so good. Amazing career. I'm going to keep watching very closely and, you know, all the best for the rest of this month.
Great. Thanks a lot.